All right, good morning. So everyone saw that homework two went out. Make sure if you haven't already, if you've already done a pull request, Varuna added a couple updates, so make sure to do another pull request to get those latest changes. And that's something that I guess I didn't even think of when we first adopted GitHub, is that now using GitHub, it's going to be really easy for us to, if we need to send you updates while you're working on your homework, it'll be really easy to do that. Otherwise, you can imagine if we were sending you guys like zip files a week into it for like a bug fix, it would be painful. So I guess that's a nice benefit. And it looks like everyone did pretty good using Git for homework one, so that's great news. And then for homework two, any coding questions, you know, just email Varun or go to Varun's office hours. And then for the written part, you know, just see me or email me. But I also want to talk about today's the student presentation topics. And I sent out the PDF to the mailing list last week, or yesterday. So this is a really important component of this course, is student presentations. And these are topics that are up to you. I have a bunch of ideas that we'll see below. And these are talks that you'll give in this course that are about 20 minutes. And it's basically the only requirement is it needs to be GPU centric. It can be, if you're interested in graphics, it can certainly be focused on rendering with a GPU. If you're more interested in compute, it can certainly be focused on general purpose on the GPU. But you can't just say, okay, you know, I'm really interested in machine learning and I'm going to go talk about machine learning in general, right? That's not relevant. But if you're going to say, okay, I care about machine learning algorithms on the GPU, maybe I care about k-means or something like that, then certainly that would make a great topic. I also encourage you to pick, we're also going to do big final projects really after spring break, and I encourage you to pick a topic for your presentation that may overlap with your project. Make an overlap basically 100%. This could pretty much be research up until your project, and that's completely okay. Or it can be completely separate if you really just want to go very broad in this course. But what I'd like from you guys is by this coming Tuesday, so anytime Tuesday, so we'll have them for class a week from now on Wednesday, just email me your three top choices for your presentation topic, and wait till after class to email me, so there's no like, you know, unfair advantage if you're on your phone or something right now. However, it's usually pretty rare that like, usually you're either going to get your top choice or your second choice, even if you don't email me right away. But if you're gung-ho about something, I encourage you to email me right away. And I have a bunch of selected topics here. And this is by no means, like, pick if you have a separate topic, that's almost even better than something that I have here. So don't feel that you're limited by what I have listed here. But in graphics, you'll see some of the stuff that I have here I think are really up and coming ideas in the community. Like, you look at alternative rendering pipelines, and this is, instead of rendering using OpenGL or Direct3D and a traditional rasterization pipeline, we write our own rendering pipeline, whether that be ray tracing or point splatting or anything like that, and we do it in CUDA or OpenCL. Like, to me, that's a really up-and-coming topic. Also down here we see translucency, and that almost sounds like, you know, intro computer graphics class, really. But when I say translucency, I'm really interested in order-independent translucency. Traditionally, with rasterization, as we're going to learn, we have to sort geometry and then render back to front and blend it, and it's a nightmare. But now, with the latest features in video cards, we don't have to do the sorting on the CPU. We can actually have basically a length list behind every pixel or every fragment and do the sorting at the very end. So to me, these are up-and-coming topics. And what we've seen certainly happen this year is that some of these student presentations become so cutting edge that the next year they'll make it into the course itself. And to me, when I look at the graphics area, those are two areas, the alternative rendering pipelines and translucency, they're likely to be actual lectures next semester. And then in terms of GPU computing here, I mean, I think all these areas are pretty interesting, depending on where your knowledge is with these. Definitely artificial intelligence. We also have a project pitch for an idea for doing artificial intelligence from the GPU that would also make a good project. And then also, you know, I know that there are some EE and computer engineering students in this course, so You can also do talks on general architecture, which would be fair game. And certainly looking at, say, the latest game console architectures compared to what we see in the PCs, I think would make for an interesting talk. I'd also be open to other talks. And then one other thing you'll see is a lot of the stuff that I teach in this class is foundations, right? Is architecture, is CUDA programming, is optimization, fundamental rendering, right? How to do shaders. Where a lot of these, and that's kind of like horizontal knowledge, right? A lot of these are more vertical problem domain knowledge things. So this is good to see a lot of actual applications. Okay, so for the details of the talk, you know, expect 20 minutes of actual talking with, you know, say 5 minutes for question. It's okay to go over or under like 2 minutes, but if you have a talk that's only 10 minutes, that's not good. If you have a talk that's 40 minutes, that's not good either. So try to, you know, practice and time yourselves. And you might think I'm crazy when I say this, I see it takes about 10 to 20 hours. Expect about 10 to 20 hours to prep for these talks, which is why I'm getting this out early in the semester. And seriously, even like one of these, like the first time I'm going to make a lecture, I spend even more than that to prep just one lecture, right? So definitely expect a fair amount of time to do the research and put together the slides. If any of the work, and definitely on the graphics side, if any of the work that you're researching has videos, you know, include them in class and play them. Make sure you credit everything. Like you'll see on all my slides that at the bottom, you know, I say, you know, I just give a URL from where I got the link from. I mean, certainly you're pretty much allowed to use just about any content that's out there under fair use for academic use, but I just want you to get in the habit of referencing things, especially like, you know, when I did my book, any image that I wanted to use that I didn't make myself, I had to go get permission to do so. And pretty much everyone is like more than happy to do that, but I just want you guys to get in the habit of doing that. And the last thing you want to do is use someone's image and then your talk get really popular, and then they'll email you and be like, blah, blah, blah. You know, just avoid the whole situation. And then please include references. And I will help you guys out. When you guys select your topics, I'll send you a rough outline, you know, and some references. So you won't start from ground zero. I'll do a good bit of legwork for you. And then in terms of grading for this, you know, it's pretty diverse here, where a good chunk of it is for the slides, the quality and the content of the slides and the organization, and then your actual presentation, you know, how you deliver the content. And then also, since I will come with questions prepared, and I'll certainly encourage everyone else to ask questions. So part of the grade is on, you know, how you handle those questions. And it's okay to not know everything either. Like, you should expect to know more than anyone else in the classroom about your topic. But I'm not expecting that you are the premier researcher in this given topic. You know? So, you know, you should have a reasonable breadth and depth of knowledge based on your prep, but you don't need to know every single detail. And we also give 10% extra credit here. I'll record the audio, and I'll put it on the course website. And if anyone, like, doesn't want their presentation up there, tell me, and I won't put it up. However, I encourage you to... you know, as students and you guys want to get jobs part of your portfolio, it can be, hey, I gave this talk. And they're usually pretty good. I mean, in the past, our student presentations have been really well. So it's good to have that out there so employers can see it. But I'll record your audio. And you can, I think it's a good exercise to go back and make a video and put the audio to your slides. And I'll send out some details on how to do that. But that's an easy 10% extra credit. And I think that you'll learn a lot by going back and hearing yourself talk and timing it with your slides. And if you're presenting, at least in the graphics world, if you're doing any... Do you have any questions? Do you have a question? Hey, guys. Do you guys have questions?
Sure.
Okay. So, anyway, if you're in the graphics world and you're submitting a paper, like, you always have to include a video. Like, sometimes they say it's optional, but... like, I can pretty much guarantee you, like, you submit a paper, it goes in two piles, like, with video, without video. So I want you guys to be able to, you know, to have some experience making videos. And then the presentation, you know, is 10% of your total grade. So it's a decent chunk, but it's not going to make or break you. And then, again, just email me your top three choices. You know, these are not my top three choices. I just made up top three choices. By sometime this coming Tuesday. And if you have, you know, if you want to discuss ideas, I'd be happy to do that with you. So do you guys have questions about the presentations? And these will start tentatively, you know, maybe like 3 weeks from now. I have to see exactly how many students are definitely registered at this point, and we'll interleave my lectures with the student presentations. Last semester, I did just like 3 weeks of straight student presentations, but I think the best thing to do is we'll probably have one or two student presentations in a class, and then I'll lecture for the rest of the class. Any questions? Okay, so for today, I just want to go back and finish the atomics that we were talking about on Monday. And then I'm going to briefly leave CUDA just for today and just talk about parallel algorithms in general. And we'll look at a few of them, parallel reductions, which you're actually going to code for your homework assignment, which is a very common building block. And we'll look at an algorithm called SCAN, which we use in a number of other algorithms, one being string compression, which is if we have a bunch of data and we want to compress it down to less data based on some criteria. And then also summed area tables, which are useful in a lot of applications. One of them is a depth of field or a kernel, or very quick box filters for kernels of arbitrary sizes. But before we do the parallel algorithm stuff, let's just go back and finish up the atomics, right? So we said last week that if we had some value out in device memory or even in shared memory, and we had all of our threads, you know, incrementing it, we don't necessarily know. Plus plus count here is not atomic. That's a read, modify, and write, and that read, modify, write is not necessarily an atomic operation. So if we have, say, 8 threads doing plus plus count, we don't know what the value of count is going to be. Right, it could be 1 if they're all in the same order, or it could be 8. Right, so we really want atomic operations where we won't be able to guarantee the order of how these are ran, but we'll be able to guarantee that the plus plus count is executed atomically, or read, modify, write is considered one operation. And these are function calls that are built into CUDA. The operators aren't overloaded here. You can't say like plus plus or plus equals and expect that to be atomic. We actually have to do these function calls. And really, they're really easy to use. But I want to talk a little bit about some potential implementations if you wanted to add your own. So I gave you, here's a simple atomic add where I just say, okay, you just lock, and the lock could be as coarse or fine-grained as you want. This is a very fine-grained lock, and I made up this _ lock keyword that does not exist. And this is a fine-grained lock because it's just locking for the particular address, not across all possible atomics, which would be probably insane in this case. So I just lock and increment, right? Pretty simple. But CUDA exposes a function that we can use where we don't need to lock, and this is an atomic compare and swap. And I know there's a question on Monday, and this is a single instruction in PTX, which is their virtual ISA. So I can't guarantee that it maps to a single instruction on the hardware, but it very well may. But it's a single instruction in the virtual ISA that CUDA gets compiled down to. And a compare and swap, what we do is we pass in the address of the variable that we care about, the value that we think it is, and a compare and swap will say, well, if we dereference that pointer and it is the value we think it is, then we're going to change it to a new value and return an old value. Right? You might also hear compare and swap or exchange. There's usually a few different terms this will go by. So here I'm making up the implementation, and again, this is a single instruction in the virtual ISA. But just so it's more concrete, I want to show you guys what the implementation would look like if I were to write it in my fake world. Where here, again, I'm locking on the address. I dereference the pointer. I get the current value. And I say if the current value is my compare value, then I'm going to assign my new value. Otherwise, I just assign the old value, which is the same thing as not doing anything. And then I return the old value. Right, so this is compare and swap. Right? So if the comparison is true, then we swap them, so to speak. So here's some examples. Where here I'm calling this function, the pointer points to 1. And when I call this function with a compare value of 1 and a val of 2, it comes in and says, right now ADR points to 1, so I will swap. So I'll assign 2 to the when I dereference the pointer and I return the old value of 1. Now, what about the next one, when my compare value is 1 and I'm trying to set the value to 3? What does that do? It doesn't work. So it says it doesn't work, meaning it doesn't do an assignment, right? Because my compare is 3, but the value is 2, right? So it doesn't do an assignment, and it just returns my current value, which is 2. But now, for the final call here, I said, hey, my compare value is 3, so then it will do the assignment. It will assign 3, and then it still returns the old one, 2. Atomic compare and swap. Okay, so now if I gave you atomic compare and swap, how would you implement an atomic add? Do you think you could? Or do you think it is possible in general? So let's look at the implementation. The answer is that you can. And I think the best way to think about this, even before we look at the code, is I think about source control. When I first, like what we're using here, Git, my first programming job, I was using something called Visual Source Safe. Have you guys used Visual Source Safe? Does anyone? One person uses it. Visual Source Safe was Microsoft source control, and it integrated at the time I was programming in Visual Basic 6. Right? This is a long time ago. And you know, you had your code in a central repository, and if you wanted to work on a file, you had to lock that file, so you're the only person that could work on that one file, right? So say, you know, you're working on your project and you have some CPP file, or this time it was Visual Basic, but it still would work with C++. And I go, okay, I'm going to modify the CPP file. Now, when I am editing it, it's locked. No one else is allowed to edit it, right? And that's kind of like locking in when you're doing parallel programming. Whereas now, when I use Perforce, I can modify a file and someone else can modify a file at the same time. And then whoever gets to it, whoever submits first, they're good, right? Because the code didn't change, just like in our compare and swap. You know, the value is still the same, they submit. But now, say, I'm editing a file, the other person's editing a file, that person submits their code. Now I go to submit my code, right? Well, my code potentially needs to be merged with their code. Right, so now I need to put, you know, either the merge is automatic, which happens all the time, which is great, or I have to manually do the merge, right? So this is kind of, well, we're not going to lock, and we're going to just kind of retry, right? Do you guys see the differences here between this old source safe way and the perforce way? Because this code works a lot like the perforce way that I'm telling you here. So in order to implement the atomic add using atomic compare and swap, we basically will keep trying the compare and swap until it succeeds. So here we're going to pull out the current value that is being pointed to. Okay, and now we're going to say if that value hasn't changed yet, because we're in this loop and there could be other threads going on, then we're going to set it to the value to val plus assumed. Okay, so we're going to increment it by the incrementer here. And then we're going to look at the old value, right? And if the old value that we pull out of there is the one that we expected it to be, then we're good and we're going to exit. Otherwise, we're going to keep looping until we get in there and there was no changes and we can increment it by val. So let me ask you one question. Is why is right here... Why are we using assumed here and not just dereferencing the address? Is that what I want to ask? Actually, no, I don't want to ask that. Oh, sorry. So when this function returns, the value is not necessarily star address plus val. Do you guys know why? Okay, so if this loop only executes once, the return value is just going to be star address, which is, you know, just dereferencing the pointer, plus the value. Right, but do you guys see that this loop can go multiple times if the atomic compare and swap doesn't succeed? And that's completely okay, because all we're saying is that this is atomic. We're not saying, we don't guarantee any order, it's just this is an atomic operation. But other increments may happen out of order. So that's really it for the compare and swap. I want you to know that that building block is there. However, a lot of these compare and swap functions, or excuse me, a lot of these atomics for add, you know, for add and subtract, etc., they're already built in. And they're in the CUDA programming guide too, if you want to see more details on them. And then as we discussed last week, right, we want to use atomics because threads from different blocks can now coordinate via global memory. We want to do it sparingly, however, right, because it really kills parallelism if you have a lot of contingency here, and also going to global memory is expensive. Okay, so do you guys have any questions on? To me, you know, atomics are not they're important, but you know, it's important to know that you should use them as sparingly as possible. But do you have any other questions when we look at just the foundations for CUDA, right? When you're looking at grids and blocks and threads and warps and shared memory and registers, are you guys pretty comfortable? Like we've really covered the foundations at this point. So I want to spend the rest of the day talking about some parallel algorithms, some building blocks. And then we're going to enter two lectures on CUDA performance, where we're really going to look at tuning CUDA, you know, where we really separate, like I said, the 10x performance from the 100x performance gain. All right, so let's jump into parallel algorithms here. So this was a class group assignment last semester, but then I got mixed feedback on doing the group work. So I just want to ask the class, right? Say I gave you an array of numbers. And I want you to find the sum, right? And right, the sum here is 6. What would be, I can give you an easy and naive, trivial sequential algorithm to find the sum, right? Where you just set something to 0, you go through a for loop, and just keep incrementing it as you read each element of the array. Well, how would you guys implement a parallel algorithm to find the sum? Yep.
Add a pair at a time.
So you're saying maybe I get a 1. I get 5. Okay, now what do I do?
Add them.
No, I used. Okay, so you said that this add and these two adds can be done in parallel. Right, and the more numbers we have, the more parallelism, right, is potentially here. This is a really bad example, right? So, yes, that's exactly what you do. Now, let me ask you this. What if I was trying to find the maximum value? How would we do it? Same array. I'll redraw it over here, and I'll unsort it so it's slightly more interesting. How would you find the maximum value? Yeah?
You could compare. It would be the same as, well, one way you could do it is the same as the adds, only instead of adding each time, you're just comparing.
So you look at these two, and what do you get?
You would get 3, and then you would get 2 and 1, and you get 2. And then you compare the new 2 and you get 3. But the problem with that is that
so in a naive implementation, certainly yes, it'd be a lot of memory access here. But right now, I mean, we should for the moment, we're going to free ourselves of what we know about the actual architecture, the GPU architecture, and we're just going to think in parallel. And on Monday, we're going to revisit this
understanding. Yeah,
okay, perfect. Right. So you guys see the similarity between doing the add and doing the max, right? So all of these that I have up here, the sum, max, product, and average, with the exception that you'll have to do a division at the end. These are all really these all have the same algorithm outline. Right, and we call any operation here where we have an array of numbers and we get a single number back, we call it a reduction. Right, like we're reducing the amount of data there. And a parallel reduction means that we're going to do it in parallel, right? And you know, you guys have seen the algorithm here, right? Where what we've done is we pick pairs and we've added these things pairwise. And now when we go to do our next, and that's all in parallel, right? Bang. Now when we go to do our next iteration or our next add, our stride right there, our stride is just one, right? You can see it goes index 0 adds index 1, index 2 adds with index 3. Now our stride widens as we go down in our iterations of the loop. And that's it. Conceptually, a parallel reduction takes, like, it's incredibly useful, and it takes, you know, 3 minutes to explain. One thing, though, since I didn't want to make it this easy on your homework, is for the written parallel reduction homework question, I don't give you a 1D array. I give you a 2D block, which is how we used to do this when we were using the graphics pipeline. So, say I gave you guys this matrix, which is not the same matrix on the homework. But if you can do this one, you should be able to do the other one. Here, I took a 1D array. I turned it into just a 2D grid or 2D matrix. Now, when I do this reduction, instead of just adding two numbers, I'm going to add four numbers in every pass, okay? And you can pick. In fact, there's trade-offs between how much you do in each step versus how many steps you have, right? So here, say I do 2x2. So this is a 4x4 matrix. If I do these additions, again, which can all happen in parallel, how big is my matrix going to be? 2x2, right? Then the upper left, what do I have?
4.
And the lower left?
8.
Right? 16. Right, 12. Now, if I repeat the same thing again, you know, add them up. What do you get? 24, 40. So I have less passes, right, when I do this, but I did more work in each pass. And you may wind up, and you can bet it would be great for you to make a graph. I don't think we put that on the assignment, but we probably should have, and see where the performance curve is. Brad, everyone sees the similarity between what I have on the slide over there and what you see here. Right? Does everyone see that? Because in CUDA, you're just going to write code that works in that 1D array, so it can be very obvious. In the graphics world, we used to draw images where the colors were these values, and then we kept redrawing the image as a different size in order to implement this parallel reduction. It was crazy. It was painful. And thankfully, we don't have to do that at all anymore. Okay, so in this case here, where we're adding two elements in each pass, right? You wind up with log n passes. So here, if you have eight inputs, right, log of 8 base 2 is 3, 2, 3 is 8. You know, and it also looks kind of just like, you know, a binary tree or any kind of basketball tournament, right, where maybe you have 8 teams, then after the first round you have 4 teams and 2 teams and 1 team. Okay, so reductions, you guys, everyone's comfortable with that, right? And we use addition in our example, but it doesn't have to be addition. Okay, so I want to start talking about an algorithm called SCAN, which is probably the most important building block, right, for parallel programming. And I'll introduce it using the term all prefix sums. Not that I'm going to use this term the rest of the semester. I'm certainly not, but I want you guys to know that scan all prefix sums are basically the same thing. And that, so if you ever see literature related to the GPU that is saying all prefix sums, that they, you've seen it. Right, so for this algorithm, I'm going to give you an array here, denoted A0 to AN minus 1. And I'm going to give you some operator that can operate on two elements of this array. And for our purposes, it's addition. Just think of it as it just adds two numbers. And we'll give you some identity value, which, again, for our purposes, will be 0. And the output of this array, it's the same size as the input. The first element here is just the identity, which should just be 0. The second element will be the first element of the input. Okay, so far, very easy, right? Now, the third element here takes the first two elements of the input and adds them, assuming that this operator is addition. And then the next element takes the three input values and adds them, and so on, all the way up until you'll see the very last one. The very last element of the output takes all the elements of the input except for the last one and runs the operation on them. And this is, will be concrete with an example. And you may recognize this from the first day of class. Right? I briefly went over, I said, hey, we're going to cover parallel algorithms, and here's an example. So here's our input along the top here. Right? And the easiest way that I think to conceptually like do this on paper is put a 0 in the output. And then go 0 plus 3 up top, gives me 3. Right? And then 3 plus 1, come back down, is 4. 4 plus 7 is 11, and so on and so forth. Right? And then you'll see at the end here, you'll do 16 plus 6 gives you 22. And then we ignore that top 3 there. So this is very sequential. Yep?
The example again, you're taking 4 at a time. So you take 4 at a time, and internally you sequentially add them, right?
So each... these four, this would be four threads right here, right? And each thread will do four additions, depending on how you want to look at it. And that is in one kernel, and you can say that, yes, that is sequential. Those inside of here would be sequential.
So wouldn't it be faster if you do two at a time because it's a binary thing?
Good question. Yeah, you should run some graphs and see, and because there's other factors too that go into it as well. I will tell you that a lot of times when you see it implemented, you see two at a time is the most common thing that's done. And now in the graphics world, four at a time, because we had a look at it in a 2D block, that's what you saw being done as well. However, I don't want to corrupt you with graphics information, but in the general graphics world, though, you would actually see a lot more than 4x4 being done at a time, because doing multiple passes has a lot of overhead involved that we don't necessarily have in CUDA, so they would actually make these things even bigger to reduce the number of passes. But that's more like implementation detail than straight algorithm. And do you guys have other questions about reduction? I certainly don't want, we're in no rush. Okay, so back to those all prefix sums here. This looks sequential. Certainly the way I'm explaining it to you guys, right, this looks like a very sequential algorithm, right? Well, you write a for loop, and you can just continue to increment. And, any result in the output is based on the previous value in the output plus one value from the input, right? It looks like a sequential for loop. Okay, so when I say scan, it's all prefix sums. It's that simple, right? They're the same thing. We'll use scan because I think it's more widely used. And a lot of times when you hear scan, people are really talking about exclusive scan, which is exactly what we've seen so far, where the output has the first element is the identity, or a 0, and the last element of the input is ignored. Right? Now, there's also something called inclusive scan, or sometimes pre-scan. This does not put the identity as the first element in the output. Instead, the first element of the output is the first element of the input, and we wind up including the last element of the input with the output. Right? So here, this is not 22 plus 6. This is 22 plus 3. And we can convert from one to the other pretty easily, right? So if you were to compute exclusive scan, how would you create, how would you transform that into inclusive scan? Okay, I'll start. What if I took the, go ahead.
Just minus the first element.
Minus the first element. So, no, I said start with exclusive scan, right? So.
Just add zero on an order list.
Add zero what? No, if I'm starting with this guy, he already has a zero, and I want to get here.
We go to zero and add the first.
Add, yeah, I'm not.
Add the last element.
Add the last element, right? So what you do is you shift everything to the left. Okay, we drop the zero, and now you're the same up until this point here, and then yes, you take this value, add it to the last element, and then put and get 25, right? Going the other way is even easier. If you have inclusive scan and you want to get exclusive scan, shift to the right and then put a zero as the first element. And I have some examples here. Are you guys comfortable with the terms inclusive and exclusive scan? Right. Exclusive has the zero. Okay. Okay, so scan, it has a number of use cases that I briefly mentioned at the beginning. One is stream compaction, and we're going to see that if I give you an array of numbers or an array of data, and I say I only want data that meets a certain criteria, it's greater than zero, it's non-null, and I want to preserve order, that's stream compaction. It's not like a compression algorithm. Think of it as really compacting data down. One thing that's great about stream compaction is that there's a bottleneck when you have to transfer data from the GPU back to the CPU. So we can use stream compaction to only send back relevant information from the GPU to the CPU. Right? So you might run this. This might not actually be part of your core computation, but at the very end of your computation, it may be more efficient to run stream compaction, send the data back to the CPU than it would just to send all this boatload of data back to the CPU and then deal with it there. And then we'll look at some area tables, which they have a lot of different uses. The most interesting use, I think, is for approximate depth of field, for doing fast box filters for approximate depth of field. And I'll show you a concrete example. And then for implementing a sorting algorithm, radix sort scan is a foundation for it. Okay, so in general, we can take scan can take certain kinds of sequential functions and turn them into a parallel function. Where basically, when you see the sequential implementation here, where if f is implemented as just, you know, if f takes some input a, f, right, just if it is just return a, you have scan right here. That's all this is. But it allows us to transform functions of this nature. Man, it keeps on my mouse. Where basically we can do all the function calls, f, in parallel, and then finally do a prefix sum in order to get the results that we're after. So it's a nice transformation. Now, let me ask you guys, you know, how would you guys, and this maybe is not quite as easy as the parallel reduction, but how would you guys implement this in parallel? Any ideas? I gave you an array of numbers, and I'm asking for, say, you know, inclusive scan, exclusive scan. I'll take either one because we can transform between them really easily. Well, let's take a look. Okay, so first, the sequential scan, right, is very simple. Where every addition here, every value for the output is a previous value in the output plus the previous value of in the input for exclusive, at least. So an array. So this is just n adds for an array of n of size n. Right now, when we're going to look at what we'll call a naive parallel implementation for scan, and we're going to look at the work complexity, where here this is really just number of adds. So in the sequential case, it's n, right? In the parallel case, we're going to see it's more than n. A lot more than that in the naive implementation. But with the added parallelism, a lot of times it will be faster. So well, once you add some other optimizations that we'll talk about on Monday. Okay, so here it is. This slide is actually quite a bit to take in, but we have an example to go through it that I think will make a lot more clear. But it's going to be the same as the parallel reduction in that it's going to be log n passes. So here our input is size 8. So log of 8 is 3, and it's going to be 3 passes to get our final output. The code is this 4 lines of code here. Right? And when we look at this, I really want you guys to pay attention for what iteration in the loop are we in, D, and then what is 2D minus 1. And if we walk through the loop and we track those two values, we'll see that the algorithm is pretty simple. And based on what you see down here, is this inclusive or exclusive? Oh, man, can you guys read that? Oh, you have the slides. So this is what we're seeing here is going to be inclusive because it's going to include the first element. Okay, so let's just walk through the example. When D is 1, okay, 2 to the D minus 1 is 2 to the 0, right, which is 1. So when we look at this sum down here, and this is all done in place in our example here. I'm showing, you know, two different arrays. But we're overwriting the same array in this simple example. Okay, so 2d minus 1 is 1, right? So k needs to be greater than or equal to 1. So we already have 0. This never changed. So we're only going to be modifying these values. So here, when k, let's just say, you know, k is 1, right? We're going to get the value of, we're going to drop down 1, and then 2 to the d minus 1 is 1. So we're going to get the previous value from the input. Right now, as k goes on, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to take the same element from the array and the previous element and add them. You probably have like 10 slides because of that animation. I apologize. Looks great though, right? So here the stride is 1. Right, when we do this addition. Now remember, in my made-up language, this is in parallel. All those additions happen in parallel, right? You guys see that at this point, there's no synchronization is necessary to do that. So it just goes like that. Right? Now, in the next iteration, D is going to be 2, okay? So 2 to the D minus 1 is 2 to the 1, which is 2. So now our stride here is going to be 2. So let's take an example here. K is 7. Okay? So this addition here, we're going to take x subscript 7, which is 13, and then we're also going to do x 7 minus 2, which is 5. So now we've bubbled up 4 additions. Right? We had 4, now these 2, now we have 22. And we do that for all k greater than, in this case, greater than 2, greater than 2 to the d minus 1. Now, when d is 3, for our final iteration here, right, and now our stride is 4, and now you'll see our final value here comes summed, just like we did in the parallel reduction, it comes summed from basically the entire length of the array, and we wind up with... Yeah, I think we have a typo. Oh, sorry. So that's just that. I don't think I'm showing this side. Yeah. I'm going to fix this slide, but these values here look wrong. How did I not catch that last semester? Man, that's embarrassing. Okay, so this algorithm, you know, we call it naive right now because it has a lot of additions in it. Right, we said that we only need n additions in a sequential version. This version, if I go back to the code, has a lot more than n. In fact, if you're really strict with your analysis here, and you were to ignore this if statement, you would say that there's n log n additions. Right? In practice, there's really less than that because you have this if statement. But since you have log n passes, it's potentially n log n. So we're going to look at Well, actually, we're going to look at optimizations for parallel reduction, but some of them are also applicable to scan as well. So tell me, what questions do you guys have about this code and this example here? I mean, when you work through it on your own, really just track D and 2 to the D minus 1, and I think it's pretty cut and dry. Okay, good. Okay, so let's look at stream compaction here, where I know I've already explained it, but just to go over it again. I'm just going to give you an array here, and I'm going to say preserve, or, you know, I only want things that meet a certain criteria. And in this case, I'm going to say maybe all these light blue ones, these are all null. And I want only the non-null values. So I want A, C, D, G. And I want you to preserve order when you do that. All right, so if we were to do this in a sequential algorithm, again, this would be pretty simple to blast over it, right, with a for loop. But I care about a nice parallel implementation. Oh. What? So how would you guys do this in parallel? What ideas do you have? Okay, so what if I said using scan would be useful? Any ideas at all? Okay, so let me show you the first step in doing this, and maybe you guys can help me do the rest of it. I'm going to say we're going to make a temporary array, and if an element meets the criteria, if it's non-null, I'll put a 1 in that corresponding array element. If not, I'll put a 0. Oh, man, that's a lot of slides. Now, we can do that all in parallel. Everyone agrees with me, right? We'll make another array that's the same size, and either it has a 1 if it meets the criteria, and it has a 0 if it doesn't. Okay, so if I were to give you this array, and both of these arrays, any ideas now on maybe what our next step could be if we were trying to compact this down to just A, C, D, G?
Use
the new array to mask out the old one. Okay, do you have more?
Run a parallel scan on the temporary array, and then you get the index values, I think, of the ones which are non.
Okay, that sounds pretty interesting. Are you thinking the same thing he's thinking, or you have another idea? Okay, so we have this new array down the bottom here, right, with zeros and ones. Now, if I run exclusive scan on it, look at my results. I have 0, some 1s, some 2s, some 3s, a 4. Okay. So with these results, what do you think we could do? What do you think?
If the values don't change, the previous ones are...
Come again?
If the values don't change, the previous ones are zero.
If the values don't change, what values don't change?
Of the array, like the previous element and the next element, if they are the same.
So give me an example. Right here, 1 and 1?
Yep.
Okay, if these don't change, what does that mean?
So the previous element was 0, like the first one.
Okay, so what about this case here when you have this 2? What does that mean anything then?
Oh, wait, so... if the scan result, like the... ones that weren't masked out, like 0, 1, 2, 3, you use them as the indices of the new array.
So
if that generated array, like so if you have a new array with 4 elements, let's say 3, it's like 0 inclusive. Okay, so 4 elements and you want to figure out what elements to put in there, then or where to put things, then A you would put it in at 0.
Do you guys follow that? You guys see what he said? So what we can do is this bottom array, the results of the scan, these are memory addresses, or these are indexes into an array, into our output. But since we do have duplicates here, right, we have one and one, or we have a bunch of threes, the only times that we have duplicates is when we have zeros up here, when the original input didn't meet our criteria. Those we don't care about. We only care about the ones where the original input met our criteria. And if you look down at all the yellow ones, we have 0, 1, 2, 3. They're all unique cases. What? And? Sure. You and them? Yeah, but if you and them, you're right in that you only have your output, but we're trying to compress it down, and we only want, our output should just be A, C, D, G, all sequentially. Right, is that, hopefully, did I make that clear from the beginning? Like, when I'm talking about stream compaction, it's not just finding the elements that meet that criteria, but it's putting them all sequentially next to each other in memory. So we see the results of the scan, 0, 1, 2, 3. Those are all indices, you know, once I mask them out from the middle array. Right, look at this. So here's the final array. I say A meets my criteria, it goes in the 0. C meets my criteria, and its scan result is 1. D meets my criteria, scan result is 2. G meets my criteria, scan result is 3. So we call this scatter when we're writing to arbitrary memory addresses like this. And when we used to hack up the graphics pipeline to do general computation, scatter like was not possible. You know, because you can like read from textures, but you can't randomly write to textures. And so this was like a huge deal that when it became easy to do this. Okay, so when I say scatter wasn't possible, it wasn't possible without like an incredible amount of work that was like too painful, I would say, compared to what you see here. And then you guys see that this scatter, this can all happen in parallel as well, right? Where it's basically you check to see if I have a 0 or a 1. If I have a 0, I do nothing. If I have a 1, it's okay to write to the final array in parallel. Yep?
You're not checking the value of x ever.
Of X?
H.
No, I did check it though. When did I not check it? I mean.
So you're doing an addition, right? So if H is 1, nothing changes in the last array.
If H is 1, nothing.
Then it should go to 4.
So this address here is different than if you have a this number will be one greater than the previous address here. Like this will be, if this was 1, this will still be 4.
Yeah.
And it will definitely work out. I mean, if there was a 1 anywhere along here, this value is going to be 1 higher. I'm pretty sure about that.
I'm just wondering what would happen if H were actually a valid value?
Yes. Yeah. If this were a 1 here, then we would. Oh, you're saying like you don't know how big the array would be here?
So now whether or not to include H because it's an
int. Oh, I would include H, right? It doesn't matter the type of scan that we're doing. H, we're including H because it would meet the criteria.
But then.
You're analyzing the criteria result, which is 0 or 1, to see if it should go into the array. The scan result is used to give you the index into the array. Why don't I do a small example? I think stream compaction is pretty important, so let's do a small example on the board. Let's just do 4 elements, A, B, CG. And I'm just going to say that, you know, my criteria is, say, 0, 1. So you guys are happy that this last element is included? Right. Okay, so run exclusive scan. I'll give you guys the first value. 0. Okay, so what do you guys get here?
1.
1? Everyone's okay with having 1? What do we get here?
1.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. 0. 1. 1. Right. Okay. Yeah, you're right. There's an issue here. This is definitely not good. Well, no, sorry. There's no issue.
2.
Yeah,
it's
man.
2 because it adds the.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Making me do things I didn't.
Yes, 1.
1.
But it's included. It's just 0 and 1.
Here and down. It's definitely 1. We got like 50-50 vote here. Okay, so we have 2 values that meet our criteria, right? The B and the D. Okay. This is 0, we do nothing with it. This is 1, index is 0. Here is 0, we're going to do nothing with it. Here is 1, we're going to write D to 1. Is everyone comfortable with that? Hopefully you guys are more comfortable than me. No, I'm kidding. And there's a question like this on your homework here where you just walk through one like this. Okay. Okay, so that's it for the stream compaction for now. You guys are cool. Okay, so the next one I'm gonna show you summed error tables, which will end today. It's simpler than stream compaction, and it uses scans. And if I give you any more hints, I think you'll figure out the whole thing. Okay, so summed area tables, these may be familiar to those of you that are doing graphics or that have done some image processing. But think of a 2D matrix, or think of an image, and a summed area table is a table that is the same size as, say, the original input, but each value, like here this 9, is the sum of all the inputs below it and to the left. Okay, so as you move up and to the right, the summed error table is greater than or equal to. Right. So let's just walk through. I have an example that we'll walk through in a second. But so why do we care? Okay, so we care because when we say you're doing image processing and you're doing blurs, like for example a box filter, you wind up, you have an image, you have one pixel, and you need to read surrounding pixels in order to blur it. And here's a really simple case, where I might be trying to blur this guy, and I'm going to read surrounding pixels. And this kernel size right here, we'd say, is 3 by 3. It's 3 this way and 3 this way. But a lot of times, I want an even bigger kernel size. I might want 5 by 5. I might want... Actually, I'm working on something at work where I'm using blurring for... Not for blurring, but for something else. And I have no idea how big the kernel... We still don't have to figure it out yet. But the kernel size needs to be, like, fairly big. The problem is, as it gets bigger, you can imagine if you're going to do this for every pixel, it gets really expensive because there's a whole lot of memory reads. So one thing a summed error table is really good for is that if you're going to do a simple box filter here, which is just an average as opposed to like Gaussian it or another type of weighting, the summed error table, we can compute the filter very quickly, as you see here, where you just need to do 4 reads from the summed error table and divide it by the width and the height, as opposed to doing a whole bunch of reads. So it's kind of like pre-computing. The summed error table pre-computes a bunch of values that makes the filter really quickly. Makes the filter able to execute really quickly for a variable size blur. And then one example that we'd care about variable size blur is a technique called depth of field, where depending on how far you are from the focal length for the camera, you're going to blur either more or less. And that we'll use, so the kernel size will vary depending on the depth from the camera. And this is approximate depth of field too, just so I'm clear. So depth of field as like a physical phenomenon with a camera lens does not work like this. Like this is just an approximation that looks good, right? Just like, you know, a lot of things, like even like ray tracing, straight up ray tracing, light doesn't actually work like that, but it looks really good and it works well most of the time. There's a lot of recent work being done on depth of field. And if you're doing graphics, this would be a great project. We had one or two last semester. One last semester in this class, and maybe one in 660 as well. But anyway, I won't go on all the graphics now. We'll do a lot of graphics coming up. So here's an example for a summed area table, just to make sure it's concrete. Here's our input on the left. Here we just get one. Now as we go over to the right, we keep summing that row from the input. We get four. All right, now when we go up to the next row, we're summing all the previous values. So here this five came from the 2x2 underneath it, and including it. And so on until, for example, this 9 was the first two columns of the input of the input image. So in terms of just what a summed area table is, do you guys have any questions on like what it looks like in terms of the numbers? No? Okay. So, you know, what do I want to know, right? Which is how would you implement this? Right, so here it is, and I'm asking for a parallel algorithm to implement this. It is easier than stream compression, and yeah, I'd say it's easier than stream compression. And it uses scan. What ideas do you have?
It seems like, at least in that example, each column of the summed area table is a inclusive scan of the corresponding column in the input image. So 1102, when you run a scan on it, it becomes 1224.
So okay, I see.
That falls apart after the first column.
Right. Okay. So good. Okay, so you are correct in that this column here is definitely a scan, an inclusive scan of this first column. And you're also correct in that the second column is not an inclusive scan of this column. Right. Okay, so but that's a really good starting point. So given that, what do we think? What can we do? Yep.
Can we do inclusive scans horizontally first?
So you want to do two passes of scans?
Yeah.
And go ahead. How are you going to do them again?
So on the bottom it would be 1, 2, 2, 4, and then the row above would be 1, 3, 4, 4, and then you do that for each of the rows, and then you go down, then you go up.
Okay, I think I'm following you, where you're going to do a scan for each row, and then you're going to come across and scan each column. Did you say that? Is that basically what you said? Right, sounds good to me, right? So we don't need to recall inclusive scan. I think we already know what it is. So, yeah, I don't care if you go horizontally or vertically first. I think either one should be fine. But yes, you do two sets of scans, okay? So here I'm showing scanning in the horizontal fashion, right? And now that bottom row is correct. Just like if we originally scanned in the vertical fashion, that first column would be correct. Okay, so now we do this scan all going across horizontal, and then we come up vertically, right? You're exactly right. So what, go ahead, do you have a question? So, does anyone have any questions on summed area tables? Cool. Okay. So these, you know, when we look at the reductions here, we look at scan, stream compression, summed area tables, these are really like some foundations that we're going to use to, that we can use to build bigger algorithms on. Now, to me, though, being good at writing the GPU code, it's not just knowing the parallel algorithms, right? Like, you know, because we're looking at these, and today, right, we've, for the most part, we just ignored memory. We're like, oh, you know, we don't know where this, what is this global memory? Is this shared memory? You know, we've just completely ignored that at the moment. So you really need to know not only the parallel algorithms, but you need to have a good understanding of the GPU architecture, right? And when you combine those, then I think you really have something in terms of writing really efficient GPU code. And then starting Monday, we'll look at really optimizing our code. We're going to look at reductions, and we're going to say, hey, how can we make these things run even faster? We're going to look at organizing our warps so that we get the maximum amount of parallelism. We're going to look at what, you know, how we've been talking about branches diverging, and if that happens inside a warp, that we lose parallelism, we lose efficiency. We're going to look at how do we minimize that. We're going to look at how do we go to global memory. How do we have good memory read patterns from memory such that we minimize the amount of latency that we're going to see. And we're going to spend two full lectures looking at the performance there. So that's all I have for today. If you guys have questions on the homework, you know, I'm definitely around. Otherwise, you know, you get out a little early. Have a good day.